Good morning. We're glad you're here. It's going to be a great day.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Lisa Valentine Clark.
And I am Richie T.
Coming up this hour, are you struggling to start your own business? Well, we're going to tell you about the mistakes that might be holding you back.
And coming up this morning, just 15 minutes away in your morning buzz, you're homeschooling. I know that. Kids are in the house. I have instructions for a homeschooling lesson that will apply for any age child. That's coming up in 15 minutes as part of your morning buzz.
What makes the American dream special is the idea that any man or woman can create their own successful career or business, right? There's no limit or set path that you have to take or can take to create your own fulfilling career. And many people aspire to achieve this particular dream, but either stall in the creative process or they just don't know how to get started. So here with us today is serial entrepreneur, educator, and innovator Curtis Morley to talk about us a little bit more about his book, The Entrepreneur's Paradox, and how you can turn your business dreams into an actual reality.
I'm excited to have my dreams come true. That's what I'm hearing. This is going to be.
Is that what you're hearing?
Making all my dreams come true. Welcome, Curtis.
Good morning. So excited to be on the show.
Well, we appreciate you being here because, as I mentioned before, this is a dream for a lot of people, right? To think that this is within their grasp to start a business. Is this something that you grew up just believing and always wanting to do? Or is this a sort of a newfound, you know, as an adult dream to create businesses?
It has been something I've dreamed of ever since I was a little kid. I'll remember Saturday morning cartoons, eating my big bowl of Captain Crunch, and then a Saturday morning special comes on that highlights the founder of the Snow Shack, a 15-year-old kid in California. And they kept using this word over and over again, saying that he's an entrepreneur. And at the time, he was worth over $500,000. And that's when money actually was worth something. And he was 15 years old, $500,000. And they kept using this word over and over again. And I went to talk to my mom. I said, Mom, what's an entrepreneur? And she said, your dad is. And my mind was blown.
Wait a second. Holy cow,
my dad's an entrepreneur? This is crazy. And from that day, I made the determination I'm going to be an entrepreneur as well.
Now, Curtis, I don't want to make any sort of we don't know each other very well, so I just want to throw
Where is this going?
You've written a book about entrepreneurship. It's called The Entrepreneur's Paradox, and I happen to know that there are tens of thousands of books about entrepreneurs. So, what is it about The Entrepreneur's Paradox that is so different, or what do you think that you bring to this space that other people either aren't talking about or are talking too much about?
I'm so glad you asked about that. The book really is about two things, because that's what it takes for a business, a startup, to succeed. The one side is the business, and typically you'll get either or. You'll either get a book about the business side of entrepreneurship, or you'll get a book about the entrepreneur themselves. And this book combines both in a way that really helps the entrepreneur to grow as the leader as the business grows, and then also helps them understand what it takes to get their proper business acumen, how the business principles need to be added to a really good idea to see that next level of success.
So when you give advice, and assumedly that's what's happening in the book, or whether you're just in your personal life, what kind of mistakes do you see entrepreneurs really coming to the table with when they are establishing their business or trying to get it to grow and it's just not working?
Yeah. The name of the book is The Entrepreneur's Paradox. And the paradox is that the thing that gets people into business is the very thing that will prevent them from succeeding in business. And you think, how can that be? That's what makes up the paradox is, typically, someone is really good, maybe even the best in the world at their craft, at their product, at their service, whatever it is they're doing. They're incredible at it. And that's the problem. Mm. You know, it's funny because without that, no one would ever start a business. But if the entrepreneur doesn't evolve past that, then they keep hitting this ceiling, this artificial ceiling that they can never rise above. And once they break free from the paradox, once they realize that it's time to stop building the product and start building the business, that's when things really skyrocket.
Okay, so give us an example of that, what that really looks like, what that means.
Well, I can tell you my story for sure, and it seems to be the same with everyone that I consult with and that I teach, is that at the time when I started my first real business, besides all the, you know, the little kid businesses that I started from that Saturday on, but in my adulthood, when I started my first business, I had taken in, I had a real talent in interactive media and web development, and had taken a certification. Tens of thousands of people around the world had taken the same certification, and I was literally number two in the world at building interactive media.
Hmm.
And people were saying, holy cow, what you're doing is amazing. Do you want to do it for me? And I was saying, yeah, of course. And then they said, wow, you really need to make a business out of this. And my simple brain was thinking, well, sure, if I'm so good at this, why wouldn't I make a business? And the fact that, you know, building interactive websites and really cool, fun digital media has absolutely nothing to do with building a business, building the marketing, the sales, the organization, mm-hmm. the operations, the legal. Those are a totally different skill set than building a website. But the coolest part about it is that if the entrepreneur makes the recognition, then they can switch from their mindset of, I'm going to build a website, and take those principles that they're so passionate about and apply them to building a business, and they work.
One of the flaws that I see that people fall into within this is that they have a really great idea or product. Because they're not good at one area of it, they take on a partner that typically doesn't have the same vision or whatever. That sort of grows in the early stages, and then it's two people who feel very differently about the same product. And then oftentimes those things will go away just because the one person didn't want to lean into the other skills that they needed to run that business.
Yeah, very true. And in the book, The Entrepreneur's Paradox, there's the whole section about these inflection points in the business. And one is that the business will grow beyond the entrepreneur if the entrepreneur doesn't step up. And there's really three actions the entrepreneur can take. They can step up and develop and transform and morph into the leader that's needed. They can step to the side, meaning bringing someone in, just exactly what you're talking about, and saying, okay, you run the business, and I'm just going to go back to building the websites or making the pies or whatever their specialty is. And then the last is they can step back and they can downsize and they can say, you know what, I'm going to have a lifestyle business, and it's just going to be me and maybe one or two others, and you know, I don't want to manage a giant company.
So knowing that a lot of people have these ideas and they want to, you know, move forward with it, and I think it's important to point out that you say that an entrepreneur is not defined by their business, right? And that the healthiest and fastest way to grow their company is to disassociate from their identity, from the business. How does a sole proprietor or like a small business owner do that?
Yeah, this is one of the toughest things. Like when I traditionally work with entrepreneurs, I tell them it's going to be hard, and it's going to be hard emotionally. Because we kind of go in and do an emotional reboot. We do an identity reset and say, where do you want to go? And based on the mountain that they're going to climb is how we help them disassociate. Because oftentimes you look at businesses and, you know, I run through a set of questions in the book, The Entrepreneur's Paradox, of, okay, is your business named with your personal name?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times the answer is yes. Is it using your personal bank account? Oftentimes it's yes. And we go through and identify, oh, I'm really taking the identity of the business, where the entrepreneur is a key piece, the key piece of a business. But if the entrepreneur says, I am the business, then there's so many things that get in the way of growth, especially rapid growth. And that's really the goal of the book and the consulting and training, is to help people find rapid growth. And as long as they're holding on to that and they put worth of themselves in the business, then they're going to stay small.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Curtis Morley about solving the entrepreneur's paradox. That's the name of Curtis's book. Now, so many people that maybe a year ago had not ever considered being an entrepreneur, their regular employment went out the door for whatever reason, either pandemic caused or downsizing wise or, you know, whatever the thing may be. They're now looking into this space. For those that are brand new, thinking, hey, this thing that I've sort of done on the side, it's providing me a means to my end. What are those first sort of foundational steps that we can do? You talked about, like, if we can, from the beginning, sort of removing ourselves from the business. But what are other great pieces of advice if we're just starting down this road?
You know, I was really excited to be on the show because I love the positivity of the show. I love the message that is often portrayed in the episodes. And one of the pieces of the book that I love, and it really just not only helps the business, but it really helps the entrepreneur as a person, is the idea that there's one letter that can change fear into power. And that letter is S. And the example that I give is the statement, what if? Oftentimes entrepreneurs, they say, what if I'm not good enough? What if I don't get funding? What if I launch this product and nobody buys it? What if, what if, what if? And the letter, if we change that F to an S, then it's what is. And instead of fretting on the future, which just fuels fear, or perplexing on the past, which produces pain, the present is the only thing that produces power and peace. And so staying in the present, saying, well, what is? What is in my ability to do? What is in my bank account that I can spend marketing dollars on this? What is, and reframing the concern and the future fretting into the power of what do I have control of now?
I bet you have a lot of experience using that change from if to is. I'm wondering if there is a big example or life experience where you either came to learn this principle or that it just really was the pinnacle of you really living it that comes to mind when we're talking about this that you could share with us.
I'm so glad you asked that. Part of the reason I wrote the book, The Entrepreneur's Paradox, is because I have made every single one of the mistakes of entrepreneurship, every single one, and some of them two or three times, yikes. But it's so fun because one of the things that is baked into the process of entrepreneurship is imposter syndrome. And imposter syndrome is one of those things that if you think about it, if you're an entrepreneur, you're doing something for the first time ever. You're doing something in a unique way, in a unique time of life, in a unique market. It's something that has to be learned. And a lot of entrepreneurs say, well, you know, I'm the expert, or I'm great at this, I'm the genius, I'm the whatever it is. And they don't realize that they don't have to be. They don't have to be the expert. They don't have to be the genius. If a seasoned businessman or woman were to step into that role, they would be figuring it out just as much as the entrepreneur. And to overcome that imposter syndrome and say, you know what, it's okay if I don't know the answers, because no one really can. That is so liberating. It was for me. It is for all the entrepreneurs I work with, of getting through that process of, it's okay, I don't have to have all the answers, but I do have an indefatigable drive to make this work, and this crazy passion, and I'm going to tap into that. And that's so liberating, so free.
I'm going to have to explore this some more, because I constantly walk around and say, I don't have the answer, but I'm not, I'm not growing a huge business right now. It's called the Entrepreneur's Paradox. We've been visiting with Curtis Morley, the author of said book. If you're looking into reading that book, you can find it on Amazon, or you can go to entrepreneursparadox.com.
Coming up, we're going to get you caught up on what happened over the weekend.
And coming up right after this, as part of your morning buzz, you're looking at the lesson plan. You're thinking it's a little light for your homeschooling today.
I need some help.
I've got something that incorporates both Shakespeare and a whole big mess coming up right after this. You're listening to The Lisa Show. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Now, later this hour, do you struggle to get out of bed in the morning? That's a funny question, right? Because I can just hear the collective, yeah, of course.
Duh.
Well, we've got some tips for waking up without even using an alarm clock. That's coming up in about 15 minutes. But first, it's time for your morning buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now, things that folks are talking about. Patrick Mahomes, quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs, concussion.
Yeah.
People are watching the video. There's an interesting channel. The guy's name is Brian Sutterer, MD. I'm assuming that means he's a medical doctor.
That's what MD usually means.
Yes, yeah, it could be. You know,
you just make stuff up.
It could. It could be any. Listen, you have to take the internet with a grain of salt. Although he says I am a doctor, and then goes into this, he sort of analyzes the video from the football game where Patrick Mahomes had that concussion, and talks about why this is scary and what are signals that happen within it. It is more than I ever thought I wanted to know about a concussion that happens during football. But man, is it great instructional to? I mean, it's horrible that he had a concussion for sure. Make no bones about it. But it's interesting to learn so much about it and what you can learn just from watching the video. So that channel is called Brian Sutterer, MD.
Interesting.
Pretty sure it's a medical doctor. Wyoming might be seceding from the union. They decided.
Wait, what?
That's what the internet is talking about this morning. The GOP leader from Wyoming sort of offhandedly said, hey, you know what? We're considering seceding. We're going to see how it goes for Texas. So all eyes on Texas. If it's successful there, we're going to have little pockets of not the United States
luck.
Of America.
We're united.
It's a story that's not a story because he just was like, yeah, well, maybe we might. We could. We might secede. You don't know. And then finally this. Double. Toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble. A little bit of Shakespeare for you because it is Brew a Potion Day.
Now, you
got the homeschool lesson. Here's the deal. Like, you just use some chemical interactants. I mean, that will pacify kids for hours
vinegar
on end.
Vinegar and baking soda.
Yeah, yeah. I remember as a second grade kid, loved the vinegar and baking soda. 10th grade kid, same.
I know, you never outgrow it.
You can make a tasty, delicious treat out of a potion. You know,
put a Mento in a Diet Coke.
Yeah, see, you already have these great ideas. The internet is full of them. Don't do all of them. Some of them are illegal things that will get you in trouble.
Well, be careful combining chemicals.
But Brew a Potion Day is a jocular holiday, according to the website I found. It's intended for fun, not a day to use potions to harm anyone.
No.
Potion comes from the Latin word potio or potionis, which means drink or beverage. Potions are often seen as having magical properties. In mythology, they were made by witches, sorcerers, fairies, dragons, and magicians, and sometimes were used to poison, heal, or bewitch people. Common potions are love potions, sleeping potions, and elixirs. That's my favorite. If you're going to make a potion, let's make an elixir that heal or cure an ailment. Make a potion. Brew a potion. Not for harm.
Use it for good.
It's a jocular holiday. It's Brew a Potion Day, and that is your morning buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. Now, for a lot of us, over the weekend, we celebrated Martin Luther King Jr.'s Day, and typically we get work off, school off for that. And with that extra day comes an extra
Are you going to say extra? Okay. I thought you were going to say, with that extra day comes extra responsibility, and everyone else is
no,
that's not how it works, Lisa.
to do something a little bit different to extend that holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do anything that was out of the ordinary that you are either proud of or just did?
Well, I did a lot different this weekend, as a matter of fact.
When you go into a long weekend, do you frame it in a different way? Like, you know, on a typical weekend, we talk here on the show about how you like, we might make brunch or watch a movie or have a date night with your significant other or do something with your kids. But does it frame it a little bit differently?
Sometimes when I go into a long weekend, I frame it like this. Well, that's not going to be long enough.
Oh, you get discouraged before
begun. No, I'm teasing. So on Friday's Lisa show, we had a guest on talking about some of the greatest movies of 2020.
Yes.
And
we both took that to heart.
Yeah, I am not a Netflix subscriber on the regular.
Which is so bizarre to me. But
well, I mean, I have not yet cut the cable. So I get a lot of my programming through that.
Okay.
And have decided, you know what? There's only so much money. You look in the pot, there's only so much money to go around.
Yeah.
So there's that. So we decided to splurge this weekend.
What?
And get us the Netflix for the month of January. It really was silly like that within our home. Should we do it? I don't know. Do we have the list of all the things we want to watch?
Get a new streaming service? Yeah. I mean, who are we?
Well, to be clear, we have already set in our calendar the day that we need to cancel so we don't get billed for the next
month.
Funny. Really, that's how we roll. So I spent, I don't want to tell you the amount of time, but I spent a considerable amount of time watching Cobra Kai, which is
for everyone listening, I need you to understand this, as I am like, you know, doing so much stuff with my kids this weekend, you know, so it was busy.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, we got to do this. I got to do this. I got to organize this. And I'll talk about that later. But I get this text from Richie, Lisa, you need to binge Cobra Kai right now. It's
yep.
so good.
Yeah.
Lisa, you got to watch it. And I think, yeah, I'll get to it. But
so if you don't know what it is, I'll give you a little history on Cobra Kai. Mm-hmm. The original Karate Kid movies, Ralph Macchio Karate Kid.
Yeah.
Mr. Miyagi Karate Kid. We're talking mid-80s is what this film or what this series, TV series, sort of branches off of.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's sort of a genesis that I don't know that everyone knows about this, is the first season of Cobra Kai was available on YouTube Red, which was essentially like what Netflix is, but it's when YouTube tried to get into the streaming game.
I learned about it here on the show on the Morning Buzz.
Yeah, they made it available via YouTube Red. YouTube Red is not really a thing.
Oh,
it's a premium service now, right? But so they sold it. So they sold the rights to Cobra Kai to Netflix, and Netflix said, "Yeah, let's do it." So what it is you're meeting all the characters from your favorite movie from the 80s now.
If you love the movie and you're like, what would they be doing now?
Yeah, yeah.
All these years later, it answers that question, which I think is so fun.
It is full of nostalgia. And I really could talk for the next 20 minutes about this. I've got other things I want to tell you.
I know.
So I'll just say it is full of nostalgia. If you loved those movies, it is not great acting.
It's not horrible acting.
It's not horrible acting.
I'm only in just a couple of episodes, but here's the thing. I will finish it.
Yeah.
I can already tell, because I always give a new show the 3-episode trial run. If it has an actor in it in a TV show that I love, like that I think is the best thing, like Friday Night Lights or like Battlestar Galactica or whatever, I give that actor a 3-episode trial run. And I have given Cobra Kai my 3-episode trial run. And I'm in.
Is it Ralph Macchio? Is that the actor that you're giving?
I won't say,
did you get out the old Teen Bop poster from your ceiling? Out of your old...
I was a Kirk Cameron kind of gal, actually. But anyway, we digress.
Out of your old hope chest and put it up on...
I wish I had one of those.
So it's so great. And this is the only thing that I'll say about it. In the second season, they take...
spoilers.
I'm just gonna give you the build around.
Okay.
I'm not going to give you the spoil. They take an entire episode to pay off one simple joke. And I would bet 90% of people that watch that episode don't get the joke. And it made my heart so happy.
Oh, I love a
so
good payoff
very happy.
Like that. Oh, that's
and I was like,
great to know. I'm
going
to see
guys.
If I can try to figure it out. Then.
Yeah, please. And if you don't,
I like
I'll
it.
Tell
it's
you.
Like a game.
Then we'll spoil spoil it for everyone. So the other parts of the weekend, yesterday I was sitting down to do some editing and some other things, and I get a phone call from my younger brother.
Okay.
Now, the Stedman family, we've mentioned this several times before, but we have this sort of mantra that we work together to help each other be happy. But
made you like repeat that.
Yeah. But what is not stated within that mantra is that we never ask siblings for anything. Not really. Like you.
Really?
Yeah. Not too
like,
much.
What do you mean?
Because we're all very busy people.
Like, oh, so
right?
You're respectful of each other's time.
Right. So very rarely, like we'll get together for things, but very rarely is it like, hey, I'm cleaning up my house. Can you come help me clean my house or whatever the thing would be? We just don't do that. We sort of take care of our own individual homes.
Sure.
So I get a phone call yesterday from my brother that says, hey, what are you doing right now? And I'm like, oh, okay, well, here it is. I said, I don't know. What do you need? He said, my wife broke her foot. Oh. I need you to come and take care of my kids. Now, he's got three kids, one that's in the double digits. I don't know how old she is. And then one that's between that one and the youngest one who's young enough he doesn't go to school.
It's not that hard to... Anyway, 11, that's another conversation for another time, but so, I will take the controversial stand that you should know the ages of your nieces and nephews.
So
that's all I'll say. I'm going
to
make a calendar.
So I said, I'm on my way.
Yeah,
and
that's good.
And I went over and helped them out, and sure enough, they went to the InstaCare or whatever. So as I was there with the kids, we were watching a program, a Nickelodeon program called, I think it's called Kid Danger or Henry Danger or something like this. And, it's everything that a kid's show would be, right? It's
loud.
A lot of, like, mugging for the camera. It's a lot of this. But in the beginning of one of these episodes, it's the plot of It's a Wonderful Life.
Really?
Yeah. With,
it's a good story.
Yeah, sure. But the guy comes in doing a Jimmy Stewart impression. It has nothing to do with the episode. The brother who loses the $8,000 in a newspaper, he makes a cameo in this thing. It has nothing to do with the episode. The kids are laughing. They have no idea what it is. And I was like, why is this a part of the show? Now, we watched a couple of hours worth of TV because,
That's how you babysit.
That's how you babysit. I mean, I don't know.
When you're Uncle Richie. That's okay.
I don't know how to do it.
We know the deal.
So then I made them some frozen chimichangas, because... That's what they wanted, and I don't know. They have dietary restrictions. I didn't want to send them to the InstaCare because they're allergic to things. I said, you guys know what you can eat.
Yeah.
Let's make what you can eat. And then I decided, you know what? I'm gonna be Uncle Richie. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Yeah,
let's watch a little something about Martin Luther King Jr.
That's really great that you did that.
So I made him turn off all the TVs, which was a war. Sorry, parents. Now I'm starting to realize what that's like.
No,
I made them gather around me on the couch, and we watched a program for kids that was on YouTube about Martin Luther King Jr.
Cool.
Now here's the thing. Two things with it. One, I think I need to start watching kids programming more because like it was so like, well, that is an interesting fact. Well,
Taylor,
I was
your attention span.
Yeah. Well, you're right. That is cool. And really, really very, very truly and sincerely, I came away from it and I was like, wow, this is really great. But what happened was,
oh no.
So we're gathered around the couch. And we're watching the screen on, on my phone. And my brother comes home and he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, we're watching a thing about Martin Luther King Jr. because it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't tell, like, if he was like, I am shocked and amazed that you were able to get the kids to gather around your phone. Or if it was like, I thought you were just going to come over and watch TV. Like, I didn't know the sort of response around it.
Hmm.
So I don't know if it's inappropriate to try and instruct other people's children. I don't know. Depending on, I guess, what the instruction level or what the material is, I guess it could be. But yeah,
I think it's great.
Yeah, it was fun. I didn't know that he was born Michael King. Did you know that? Martin Luther King Jr., his name when he was born was Michael. This is true. This is not. I learned this in a children's video.
I love that.
His father and his father changed his name and his son's name after going on a religious trip. Came back and said, "We're legally changing our names to Martin Luther King and Martin Luther King Jr."
That's
legally
amazing.
Changed it.
Wow.
Yeah. The more you know. Hashtag the more you know.
What? You've had a life-changing weekend.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't put into place any systems and get out.
Okay. You're making fun of me because you know that this weekend I had a job. I was going to go through some of my clothes and my kids' clothes. I was going to go through some closets.
Mm-hmm.
And as I tend to do, I thought I could accomplish a lot more than I really had time
did
for.
You bite off more than you could chew? Yeah. That's what my grandma would always
say. I
did say.
That. But it was good and it feels good. And then my kids, I gathered them around. And this is a pro parenting tip. This is what I've learned after decades of parenting. Okay?
Yeah, literal decades.
And I
want
to share
this.
By the
way, congratulations.
Thank you. I brought all my kids together and they came through the door and I said, now stop right here. I've spent a lot of time organizing your closets. I got some new bins. I've organized mine. This is what I need you to do. I need you to tell me how amazing it is.
Mm-hmm.
And how great it is and how grateful you are for this.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was like, look, I got you new bins. Like, this one's for hats. This one's for hoodies.
Yeah.
Isn't this going to make your life easier? And to my kids' credit, they were like, this is amazing. Did this take you all day? Thank you so much. I feel like I need to share that parenting when I expressed my needs very simply and
mm-hmm.
clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Now, what I'm curious about, because I know
and I'm
that,
living off the high.
I know that they all said that, but do you think that there was like a meeting beforehand?
I don't care.
Where like oldest daughter is like, guys, listen, she's hanging by a thread. So whatever she asks when we get
listen,
home.
Listen, whatever private conversations my kids have with each other is none of my business.
Yeah.
You know, I used to be.
So long as the outward appearance is.
I used to be so concerned with like, you know, yeah, what are they doing? Say, you know what? Sometimes it's better not to know. And a couple of other things like that were big kind of happened this weekend. My oldest son was switching apartments. So he's going from one apartment that his landlord like sold the place. He had to quickly find another place. He found another place and actually moved in with friends. Before it was just like, hey, whoever, you know, I just need a room kind of thing. And now it's friends. And so I met him at a store, and I was like, okay, let's get you set up for your new place. And
yeah, you want to get some bins?
Groceries. We got some bins. We got some paper towels, you know, all the cleaners. And we decided what his scent profile for the new apartment would be.
Sure.
Because
sure.
you can't mix scents in your cleaners and your air fresheners.
Like every 20-something gentleman that is moving out with his friends in an apartment knows, you can't have mixing scent profiles. Sure, yeah.
So we got him all set up in his apartment. It was really sweet. And I was really excited because he was so excited to like, I'm going to put this up in my room. And before I didn't feel like I really could decorate, but now I feel like I can and to make it my own. And it brought my memories back to like how exciting that feels of like, you know, you love your family, you love your home, but being out on your own and having your own place and being really excited about it and having, you know, conversations with your roommates late at night and just being able just to like that kind of life is so there's something so cool and exciting and magical about it. And a lot of times I focus on the stress or the difficulty it is in like cutting all those apron strings, you know, as a mother, like, ooh. And I love it when there's an opportunity though that I can be excited for my kids and like share in that excitement of like, this is so great. You're going to need some curtains. You're going to need, you know, and just kind of wanting to help, but not take away that experience of firsts, you know, as we went over and the roommates were like putting together IKEA furniture. It was not going well.
No.
And I said, you know, if I felt like I had any confidence and that I could help in this area, I would, but I'm no good. But they were laughing and I just thought this is a great, exciting time of life. And it was really a kind of a cool, special thing to see it from a parent's perspective, you know, of like, oh yeah, you have no idea. They don't have any idea of like how meaningful that moment is or how much they'll look back at that and like laugh and appreciate it, which kind of also makes it special.
Yeah. I love that my takeaway from this whole thing is, hey, do you guys need help with furniture? Can't help you. But if you need help seeing which Glade plug-in is going to mix with your Axe body spray.
I know my skill set. Listen, I said, you know what I can do? While you're working on this, I can get dinner. I can get some takeout.
I want to set you guys up for success. Let's talk curtain rods.
Yep.
Can we talk about,
nobody's good at everything.
You don't mix chevrons with stripes.
Oh, don't
you
get
don't
me started.
Mix a chevron with a
They
stripe.
Don't even care. They don't even care about mixing. I said, you know, your walls are beige, so you can't get gray curtains or black. And my son looked over at me and he goes, yeah, we don't care about that.
Yeah.
Because I was like talking them through. Well, what color should we get?
Yeah.
He was like, do you have anything at home? Like cheap, free, you know.
Yeah.
That's
Will
what
you
he's
bring
interested
it?
In.
Sounds yep. perfect. Oh, it was at a cost of nothing. We love it.
Yep. That's exactly the conversation.
But you're doing okay with it, right? You came away from it and you walked away and said...
I didn't even cry, Richie, which is a huge thing for me. I let myself be in the moment and be happy about it.
Good for you. Congratulations.
Huge win for me over the week.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Now, coming up, we're going to find out what we need to do to stop needing an alarm clock in the morning just to wake up.
You're listening to The Lisa Show. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to The Lisa Show.
Our lives are dictated by our schedules. When we wake up, what time we have to be at work, when we go to bed. And this often means that sleep can fall by the wayside and we can only get a few hours in before we have to wake up. And the sound of our alarm clock is that thing that keeps coming no matter how much we don't want it to be there. It just... In a daytime, there is nothing worse to me than if I hear the sound of my alarm clock on a TV show, on a radio ad. It just has that immediate response inside of me. However, since the beginning of quarantine, we've had an unusual opportunity to use our commute times to get more sleep. So here to talk with us about using quarantine to catch up on sleep and how to train our bodies to wake up without an alarm clock. Let me say that again. To wake up without an alarm clock is Associate Medical Director of the Weill Cornell Center for Sleep Medicine and author of Let's Talk About Sleep is Dr. Daniel Barone. Welcome, Dan.
Hi, thanks for having me. Pleasure.
Now, I want to make sure that I got that right because I queued up a conversation about waking up without an alarm clock, and I don't know that I believe it.
Well, the whole notion of waking up without an alarm clock, it kind of speaks to the fact that somebody is getting enough sleep on a nightly basis.
Yeah, again, I'm not sure what that enough sleep is either.
Right. So the National Sleep Foundation put forth this this notion that the average person needs between 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night. There are definitely outliers that there are people who need less or people who need more, but a good rule of thumb is seven plus. Hmm. And what I find a lot of times is my patients will say, well, you know, on the weekend, for example, I'll get 8 hours, but the rest of the week I'm getting six. Hmm. And, you know, shouldn't I have made up for that? It doesn't really work that way. You know, you need to have consistent sleep all the way through. You know, it'd be better off if that person got 7 hours a night consistently as opposed to six during the weekdays and then eight on the weekends.
So I hear that, and I wonder, though, because we are so busy and we do this to ourselves, but do you have any sort of research as to how many people actually get that 7 to 9 hours of sleep?
Well, it's funny you say that. We as a society sleep 1 hour less than we did 100 years ago.
Hmm.
And that doesn't sound like much, but when we talk about the consequences of this, it can be disastrous. For example, the number one day for car accidents in America is the Monday after daylight savings time, right? We are a sleep-deprived society. Let's say the average person gets 6 hours a night. You take another hour out of that, and now reaction time is slowed and other things occur, and that's when car accidents happen.
Hmm.
So I think, yes, the recommendation is 7 to 9 hours, but you're right. Most people don't do that.
And it's not just the hours of sleep, it's also quality of sleep. I hope that we could spend a minute on that as well.
Sure.
How can we get better quality of sleep, especially if our hours are limited? Like, I want to get the best sleep I can.
Right. Wouldn't that be great if we could only sleep 4 good hours as opposed to, right. That's man's dream. The issue becomes what else can be triggering poor quality sleep? And that can range everywhere from a bad or poor sleep environment to poor sleep habits to something a little bit more sinister like obstructive sleep apnea, right? Mm-hmm. To not having a consistent window of sleep, right? So people who have, let's say, rotating shifts, you know, a lot of times what they'll say is, you know, the night, when if I work overnight and get my 8 hours or so in the morning, right, that I don't feel as good as if I slept overnight. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of factors go into having quality sleep, not just, as you said, the amount of time, but also the timing and making sure there's not other conditions that may rob somebody of feeling good when they wake up.
You know, I was doom scrolling the other day on social media, and I saw this idea of sleep hygiene I'd never heard of before. What is that? Mm-hmm. What is that?
Yeah, it sounds like having a clean bed, right?
Yeah, that's
what it sounds like, right? Now, what that's implying is that somebody's sleep habits are clean, okay? Uh-huh. And what we mean by that is not using the bed for watching TV, being on your smartphone, right, which we all do. I've had some patients tell me they eat in bed, right? These are all factors which kind of trick the brain to think that this bed is not my place of sleep, right? We need to be conditioned that this bed is my place of sleep and nothing else. Mm. You know, we say if you're not having sex or sleeping, you should not be in bed.
Yeah, yeah. I also, and I don't know why. It's funny. It's like we knew that we were going to have this interview because I also saw this idea of biological and social time, which were two concepts that I had never heard sort of discussed. Can you sort of define those and how they're at odds when we try and get good sleep?
Sure. So there's this whole notion of what's called social jet lag. Right. And what that's implying is so if you took this has been done in research. If you took a bunch of people and putting them out in the wilderness, right, mm-hmm. and no phones, no TVs, no electronics of any kind, just them and nature, what tends to happen is the time that they fall asleep goes much closer over time to when the sun sets. Right. Mm-hmm. And when they wake up is along with the sunrise. Okay. Now, the way society is now, especially where I live in Manhattan, it's we're kind of inundated with answering this email now or doing this now or watching my favorite show. And what happens is that kind of internal clock gets pushed later and later and later. Hmm. So what happens is you get this kind of what we call social jet lag, where it's like your brain wants to go to sleep probably a lot earlier, but because of the inundation with what we call blue light, mm-hmm. blue, you know, from screens. That what that does, it actually shuts off our own production of melatonin, and that can keep us awake.
Hmm.
So it kind of like working against what nature wants for us.
Yeah, it seems like most things are working against us for what nature wants for us. We're talking with Dr. Daniel Barone about sleep, about how we can get better sleep, about how we don't get enough sleep. You mentioned this light, blue light in particular, but just sort of light in general can really have an impact on our sleep. But what can we do about it?
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, when we say blue light, we're talking about a very specific frequency that tends to come from any kind of screen, right? So anything that has a backlit display. But what we really want to do is use the sun, right? Or the sun is our number one Zeitgeber, which means time giver. Mm-hmm. So what I mean by that is before bed, you want to really make it dark if you can, mm-hmm. right? So 30 to 60 minutes, I tell my patients, no more screen time, okay? Make sure you have blackout shades or you're getting rid of any kind of ambient light that could be waking you up. And then in the morning time, the first thing you want to do is open up those shades, maybe even go outside if you can. Get sunlight on you, because what that does, it kind of locks in to your brain, okay, this is the time I'm supposed to be awake, this is the time I'm supposed to be asleep. Okay, and having that kind of consistent schedule will do nothing but help.
How do we navigate that in the winter months? Because for me, right. if I slept by the sunlight, I'd be in bed by 5 and, you know, I wouldn't right. get up until 9 or so. How can yeah. we artificially do that?
Yeah, it's hard during the wintertime, and that's part of the reason why a lot of people get that seasonal affective disorder. I think it all kind of ties in together. You know, you're not getting sunlight, you're not feeling as good, you're probably a little more tired. What I would say in those situations is you want to just still try to maintain healthy habits. And frankly, going to bed at 5-6 o'clock for you, because what will happen is, in that case, guaranteed, you'll wake up a few hours later and it's almost as if you had a nap.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's time to really fall asleep at night, it'll be impossible to get back to bed.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are so many sort of new inventions that will help us to get sleep or to be able to wake up. I'm thinking of like these alarm clocks that create the lumens of the natural light that aren't a sound at all. Is there anything to those?
Yeah, well, again, what's happening there is the light that comes from that source, it's almost trying to mimic what the sun does for us, right? So it kind of gets brighter and brighter and brighter as the sun kind of rises up into the kind of mirror what nature would design for us, as opposed to a very abrupt sound, you know, to kind of wake you up, which is not very pleasant.
Mm-mm.
This way it kind of begins the process, because you got to remember, when we wake up and go to sleep, it's not just shutting a switch, right? It's not a light bulb that we're turning on and off. It's a process, a very complicated process that happens on a neurochemical basis. And when you kind of have that abrupt awakening, you're kind of almost superseding what would naturally happen, where, okay, this cascade begins, and then, you know, other neurochemicals are released, and then finally the body is naturally woken up in the right way. When you slam yourself awake with an alarm, you're kind of circumventing that process.
You mentioned at the top of this discussion that people will say, oh, you know, I need between 7 and 9 hours of sleep. Or, I mean, professionals would say between 7 and 9 hours. And everyone seems like they're the outlier, right? Like we wear as a badge of honor, I only need 4 hours, or you need right. 6, I only need 5. Is there right. a way, whether it's just sort of sleep testing or whatever it is, that we can really find out what our body's own needs are?
Yeah, so the father of sleep medicine, William DeMent, who unfortunately passed away a few months ago, he wrote in one of his books, he said the way to determine that is, yeah, I mean, a sleep test would definitely help us to look at that, but if you just want a quick and dirty way is kind of see how you feel in the daytime, right? Keep a track for yourself, keep a log for yourself, and if you're tired, then add, let's say, in half an hour or an hour of sleep per night. Do that for a couple weeks, then check again, right? And see if that goes up. And to the point where you're not really feeling tired anymore or feeling fatigued, that's probably how much sleep you need. Sadly, it's probably more than what people think.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What's the biggest thing that you think that people do wrong? People that will come in and you'll get a whole list of the things that they're doing. What's the most common mistake that we make?
Right. I would say it's probably two things. One is having caffeine too late in the day.
Yes.
Right. Caffeine can stay in our system for a long time, longer than we realize. And what happens is that, you know, that energy boost that they get, right? It's out of your system in 20 minutes or so, we believe.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is the caffeine chemical remains in the bloodstream. And if somebody has any trouble falling asleep at night, even just having that little bit of caffeine still around mm-hmm. can kind of trick the brain to say, ah, must not be time for bed.
Hmm.
Yeah. That's one.
So before we go away from that and get to the second one, is there a rule like 6 hours yeah. before sleep, or what's the life of that caffeine?
So the half-life in caffeine, which is basically after that amount of time, half of the substance is left in your body. The half-life of caffeine can be up to 5 hours.
Wow.
So what I recommend is usually by 1, maybe 2 o'clock latest, you want to cut that off.
Okay. So then the second piece of advice you have.
Right. So the second piece is you work a long day, you come home, you have your dinner, right? You're sitting on your TV, sitting on your couch, watch TV, and what happens? You may fall asleep. You may pass out for 5 or 10 minutes,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like an innocuous thing. Who cares? But what happens is the way our brain goes to sleep at nighttime is we have what's called sleep pressure, which kind of just sounds what it sounds what it is, which is basically over the course of the day, the sleep pressure builds up to the point where we're tired enough at nighttime to go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
When you cut that sleep pressure off by taking a nap, even if it's 5 or 10 minutes or so, especially in the evening time, that can make it very, very, very difficult to fall asleep at night because you're kind of taking that sleep pressure and letting it out, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, may we all get better night's sleep. That's what I hear about this from this whole thing. And I'm assuming if I can fall asleep literally anywhere and anytime, if I'm sitting for any length of time and someone is just quiet, the lights don't even have to go out, I'm probably a little sleep deprived. Is that what I've learned from this?
Yes, probably. sadly, we all are, but yes.
But I'm not alone. I'm not alone. Oh. Dr. Dan Barone, who's an associate medical director at the Weill Cornell Center for Sleep Medicine. You can get more information on sleep health, and you can check out his book, Let's Talk About Sleep. Thanks for being with us.
And while you're on the internet, you're checking out, you know, how you can get a better sleep, mm-hmm. right? Because I know that everyone is talking about that. You would think with a global pandemic, you know, we have more time to sleep, but we also have more time to worry. I think that's, you know, my big takeaway. While you're on the internet, go over and give us a little message. Send us a little email. We love hearing from you. We love hearing the segments that you like and also your ideas. We like to know what you want to hear about, mm-hmm. who you want us to interview.
Mm-hmm.
TheLisaShow@BYU.edu. We've been asking for a show
motto.
We can't
slogan.
Agree on what we say, but we love your suggestions for that.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I was thinking about over the weekend as in regards to this, because mm-hmm. I was like, I'm going to crack this case. You know, while I'm cleaning and organizing,
yeah.
and
I've got a system for mottos and mantras.
I came to the conclusion that I don't want the show to be one thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we all need a lot of help and a lot of encouragement and things. And so I want to make it really inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my concern.
Okay.
And so I need help.
The front runner for me right now is listen, learn, and laugh.
Yeah.
And we have to do it in an arch and in vinyl lettering.
Right.
I haven't figured out where in the studio we're going to do it, but that's sort of front runner for me right now,
mm-hmm.
of all of the different suggestions that we've received. Again, the email address is thelisashow@byu.edu. Say your name is Tom, for example. Maybe your name is Tom and you're listening to the show this morning. You love the show and you're like, hey, I want to send an email. I have yet to do that.
Well, today's the day.
Well, today's the day, Tom.
Yeah, today's the day.
And I just picked the name Tom out of a hat.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been Erica, for all I'm concerned.
Justine.
That's also a great name. TheLisaShow@BYU.edu. You can send us an email, whatever it is, because we also take our everyday rock star nominations there.
If you need a little boost, this is a great time to. We are offering something as well.
Yep.
You know, you're like, you know what? I did something that for me is a big deal. Will you highlight me as Everyday Rockstar? Yeah, we will.
Just give us some guidance in the subject line so we know what the email is pertaining to. It's thelisashow@byu.edu. Tom and Erica and Justine, we look forward to your emails coming up here in the future.
Coming up, we're going to tell you about the easiest ways to spot a lie.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Good morning. We're glad you're here. It's going to be a great day.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Lisa Valentine Clark.
And I am Richie T. Coming up this hour, do you fall for anything that someone tells you? We're going to give you some tips for spotting a lie when you see one.
Then we're going to find out what tech companies are actually doing with your personal information.
And coming up in 15 minutes as part of your morning buzz, there's a news story that's trending that I was like, no. This can't. Is this real? It turns out that it is real. You may just want to stay in bed today. I'll tell you what that news story is and why you might just want to stay there, coming up in your Morning Buzz.
I think it's safe to assume that most parents can tell when their kids are lying.
Lie!
Oh. You know, they sometimes if you have conversations with any parent and ask them, like, can you tell when they're maybe not telling the whole truth or they're telling a lie? Can you? And I think with confidence, most people would say, oh, yeah, I could totally tell.
You can spot it, but can you spot it 100% of the time? Or have you been lied to by your kids, for
example?
Oh, my
kids are pretty good.
Are they?
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. I feel like I can tell when they want something so that what they're saying isn't 100% the truth,
okay,
but kind of mixed with part truth,
sure,
withholding,
sure.
Which so is kind of a lie.
Yeah, so not a whole lie, but not a truth at all. Sure.
And when I need to press a little bit more. And that is not unusual. Studies show that most people feel pretty confident in their ability to tell when people are lying. Hmm. Like, yeah, I can tell. But a new study shows that people can almost never tell when people are lying. So while the results aren't promising, there is hope. Here to share with us tips for how we can improve our lie detector skills, you know, how to tell if someone is telling us the truth or a lie, is Dr. Nick Morgan, who's a communication speaker, theorist, and coach. Welcome, Nick. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lisa. It's great to be with you.
Now,
and hi, Richie.
Hello.
Hello. I've seen in many a TV show, many movies that really purport this idea that most people have a tell that happens when they lie. I think most notably, there was a TV show called The Mentalist that I was super into, you know, and they thought that he was just really good at telling people's tell, you know, that they either
they look up to the left, they get fidgety with their hands,
scratch their nose, whatever that is. Is this true?
Well, the problem with it is that we may have such tells. Some people do, some people don't, but they're all different. So, as you just alluded to, excuse me, I may look up to the left, you may look up to the right, I may get fidgety, and you may get very still. I'm may get shifty-eyed, and you may make rigid eye contact the whole time, like you're some sort of psycho. people have all different sorts of ways of trying to control. Basically, it's the nervousness that you get mentally when you're starting to lie, when you know you're telling an untruth, and so you have some way of expressing that energy that happens as a result of that, and it comes out in different ways in different people. So is the studies all show that we are no better than chance at reading each other's lies.
Ooh, no better than chance. Okay, so what can we do
50-50.
What could we do to better improve that lie detecting ability?
Well, the good news is that we can get to know the people within our circles, our friends, our family, the folks that we spend a lot of time with. And we can detect when they are expressing that underlying suppressed emotion.
Hmm.
And the thing to understand is most the kind of lies that we get every day, and the studies show we get lied to up to 200 times a day. Mostly those are lies just to keep the peace. They're lies like, you look great in that, or no, I'm not angry, or those kind of things. It's the sort of lies, the little lies that keep relationships at neutral, without escalating. So what you're usually doing there is suppressing some contrary emotion. And we can get good, and most of us are pretty good already at detecting suppressed contrary emotion in the people that we know well. And so we're used to our spouse, for example, and we see when there's something off with her or him. And the same, you mentioned your kids earlier. With kids, because they haven't quite learned the adult faces yet, that ability to kind of look as bland or neutral as you can while inwardly seething or inwardly laughing or inwardly scorning or whatever the contrary emotion is, it's easier to spot it in kids. But the big misconception that is out there in the social media and in entertainment is that we can become expert in spotting lies in strangers, and we're just not very good at that.
I want to turn this
because
on.
We don't know their basic ways of communicating.
Their baseline.
I want to turn this on its head a little bit. Then there are people that I know that that don't work hard to make sure that social structures are calm and peaceful, meaning, I guess, that they're fairly honest all of the time, mm-hmm. that they wouldn't say those, you know, we call them white lies or those little, you know, simple pleasantries
to
keep the peace. Is that more effective then, or just more honest?
Well, now you're dealing with psychology, and
yeah.
I'm not an expert psychologist, so you tell me, what do you think works better in day-to-day situations?
Some people
are more comfortable with that kind of honesty, and other people would rather be lied to. Again, not in serious ways, but in those little white lies.
So that's so interesting, because you said that we... And I want to put a little emphasis on it, that we're often lied to on average about 200 times a day. And that really seems like a high number. How did the study count that? And do you think that that's a problem?
Well, I was quoting you the high end. The full range of the study qualifies and hedges and says it's mm-hmm. somewhere between 100 and 200 times a day. And those kind of studies get a variety of results. So let me hedge a little bit there. But basically, it's people with clipboards following after other people in ordinary yeah. situations mm-hmm. saying, was that a lie? Was that true? Was that a lie? Was that true? And hopefully you're getting told. But the truth at that
yeah.
point. But it's a matter, remember, of ordinary life. So mm-hmm. you'd have to say all those studies were done pre-pandemic. We don't know yet
yeah.
the effect of the pandemic is on lying, whether there's more of it or less of it. But it's meant to be ordinary behavior in the workplace and in our home lives and that kind of thing.
We're talking with Dr. Nick Morgan about how to become a lie detector, know whether or not people are telling us the honest truth or, in fact, they're lying to us. And Dr. Morgan, I'll be honest with you, as you've answered each of our questions, knowing that we're lied to 200 times a day,
no.
it makes it really hard for me to believe anything that you're saying. you
well,
have
tragic, and I feel your pain, but...
I do worry that people will listen to this and be like, I don't know who to trust.
Yeah, how can I trust anyone? I guess the big takeaway then, so you did the study, they followed around, they said, was that truth, was that lie? We find that people are doing this more, so what? So what do we take away from it? Are we adjusting anything because of it? Or is it just, well, that is an interesting amount of lies that we tell on an average daily basis?
Well, it turns out a couple of things, just to put it in perspective.
Okay.
First of all, let me stress, these are what we popularly call little white lies. So these are trivial lies. This doesn't mean you're lied to in a substantive way about important things 200 times a day. Not at all. It means mm-hmm. little things like, no, officer, I was only going 5 miles per hour over that speed limit. Or yeah, that coffee tastes delicious. Thank you for making it for me.
Mm-hmm.
you look great in that blue dress.
Yeah,
that kind of thing. And these are the little, we call them lies, but these are the maybe there's a better word for it, a gentler word, like fibs that we tell just to keep the social mm-hmm. cohesion strong. The reason we're comfortable telling them is because we perceive they don't disrupt the social fabric.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas telling somebody a more substantive lie about finances or fidelity or the things that really matter to us, then those we would perceive to be disrupting the social fabric. So that's the first thing, to put that in context.
Yeah.
And second, there are two ways that you can improve your ability to detect lies. And one of them is what we alluded to earlier, which is to study the baseline of the people that you know well, because you have that
mm-hmm.
chance. So spend some time watching your spouse or your kids or your friends or your work colleagues. And just notice when they're when they're telling you the truth and they seem comfortable, and then notice what happens when you get a different vibe from them, when they feel edgy or uncertain. And you will know that because you're comfortable with them and you know them well. And so you can spot the change. Humans are not very good at detecting lies just per se, but we are good at detecting change in people's emotional state that we know well.
I love that. The change
and so
in people's emotional state. That's the thing to look for.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. And the second thing is that can improve your ability to detect lies. And this one is fascinating to me, is that if you spend more time listening to people's voices than watching their body language, then you can increase the accuracy of your ability to detect when they're fibbing, because it turns out that our uncertainty and our nervousness or edginess, to the extent that it shows up, comes up first in the voice. We humans as adults learn to mask our faces, and we put on our grown-up faces and we go to work and we pretend to be interested in what our colleague is saying for the 100th time and that sort of thing. But we're not as good at disguising the uncertainty in our voice or the tentative nature in our voice.
And that's really interesting. That's very funny. I use the example, like I joke around with my kids. They can always tell if I'm not being 100% honest because my voice gets really high. And I hadn't realized that, like, oh, I don't know. I mean, we'll see. You know, like when it's like, oh, that means no.
Yeah, and the reason for that specific one, is that when you start to get nervous or you are not being 100% truthful, then adrenaline typically starts to flow because it's not your natural state. So you start getting a little energy in your system of the adrenaline kind, and that squeezes your vocal cords and pushes your voice higher. So one of the things you could do, one of the things you could do, and I shouldn't tell you this.
No, do tell me.
It would be to deliberately pitch your voice a little lower in that situation to counteract.
No, I'm not sure. We might not be able.
Well, it's an interesting take, though, because I do try to tell myself, poker face, don't react to every little thing, because I'm extremely expressive with my face. It gives me away. So I always try to, like, keep your face relaxed. Keep your voice relaxed. And now I can say, keep your voice low. Keep your voice low.
Now I'm perfectly fine. Is the car ruined? I'm not mad.
I'm not mad. I'm just concerned.
Obviously, you're an expert at this, Richie. I'm learning from you.
Yeah, well, thank you, Dr. Morgan. You know, here, what I have found to be completely fascinating, and correct me if I'm wrong, in every instance where I see both in popular media and also I would assume in actual practice with the lie detector test, and I'm talking where the individual is connected to a machine, they do a baseline of questions to sort of get their natural response. What you have sort of crafted for us is we're doing that with our relationships minus the machine. We are able to learn, observe, gather this behavior from people, and then when we can see something different, now we wouldn't see it be different markings on a computer because they're not attached, but when we can see things out of the norm, it will help us and serve us to know if people are lying.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, and that's exactly how the lie detector works. Yes, you get a baseline of behavior, and then by asking questions like, what's your name and how old are you, and then when you pop the crucial question, where were you on the night of the 24th?
Nowhere.
Lower.
I wasn't anywhere.
Yeah, then you see the autonomic responses jump up on the lie detector test. And yes, it's roughly the same thing minus the machine in person. It's that we get used to watching other people in their natural and hopefully honest state, and then we detect the change. But remember, what we're detecting is a change in emotion. And there can be a variety of causes for change in emotion. It isn't always a lie. It's people get angry, people get upset, people get excited, they get happy. And those changes are what we humans are on the alert for.
How does lying change if we're online? Can you tell if people are lying to us online? Are there tells?
Much harder to tell because we're not getting the feedback of our five senses as clearly.
It's like we have to be more vigilant.
I think so, yeah.
I just copy and paste whatever they say into Google, and then at the end I say, is this true? And then I say...
And Google is never wrong.
Yeah. And after I...
If
I don't like the first result, if I don't like the first result, I copy and paste it in, and then I say, is this true to Google? And we get it figured out. Dr. Nick Morgan, one of America's top communication speakers, theorists, and coaches. You can find out more about Nick and his work online at publicwords.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
Coming up, we're going to learn how to protect our privacy on the internet. How to do it.
And coming up right after this, as part of your morning buzz, I couldn't believe it. It's actually true. You'll see it trending online today. You may just want to pull that comforter right over your head and stay there today. It's your Morning Buzz coming up right after this. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Later this hour, do you feel like your personal relationships are lacking? Well, coming up in about 20 minutes, we're going to help you find new purpose in them. But first, we got your Morning Buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now, things that folks are talking about. This first one, Riley June Williams. Does that name sound familiar to you? She has now been taken into custody. This is the woman who is accused of storming the U.S. Capitol and stealing a laptop from Speaker Pelosi's desk with the intention of selling it to Russian intel. So, in custody. There you go.
Yeah.
A lot of people are talking about that.
Yeah.
Add Garth Brooks to the big lineup for President-elect Biden's inauguration celebration.
Oh, Garth
Brooks will be joining Lady Gaga, who will be singing the national anthem, as well as Jennifer Lopez, among other folks who will be performing during the inaugural celebration that will occur tomorrow evening. And then finally this. It's true.
Oh, no.
You'll see this trending online today and you'll think, no.
What?
Is it? Is this true?
What?
I can't take this. Come on. We had 2020. Is this for real? And what? It is. Coronavirus has reportedly been found on ice cream in China.
Oh, Richie, I'm so sorry.
They're having to recall thousands of cartons of ice cream. There's no indication that anyone has gotten the coronavirus from the ice cream.
How did they test that?
Employees at the factory are being tested to find out if any of them have tested positive.
Okay.
There were 390 of these tainted cartons sold, and they are now working to track down those people who may have got the coronavirus ice cream. There's 31 flavors at Baskin-Robbins, and coronavirus is not one of them. But this is a real story.
Yeah.
You will see this online today.
Oh, shoot.
And it looks like it's not real, and unfortunately...
Yeah, unfortunately is.
It is.
Okay. I know how much you like ice cream, and so this one hits home, but I appreciate you reporting it nonetheless.
I can't even...
I know.
That's your Morning Buzz.
Thanks, Richie T.
We often hear that we have to love ourselves before we can love someone else. We have to be confident in ourselves before we can be confident in the relationships that we're in. But to get to a place where we love and are confident in who we are takes a lot of hard work and a lot of introspection. It requires us to be on our own for a season as we find our purpose in life. But when we find our purpose, or some people call it our path or our why, we can truly enhance our relationships. So how can we find our why, find our purpose? Well, Danielle and Howard Taylor, certified marriage coaches and authors of the book The Fundamentals of Marriage, are here to share with us their advice. Welcome, Danielle and Howard.
Hi there.
Thank you for having us. Good morning.
Yeah, great to have you guys back on the show. Now, this I'm excited because throughout the year of 2021, we're going to have you guys on every now and then to be able to speak to each chapter of the book. In 2020, we had you guys on, and you said, oh, we've got all this great advice, and we tried to cram it into a 15-minute segment, and I quickly went, no, I love Danielle and Howard so much and what they have to offer that we wanted to break each of these things out. So why is the you, I, and why the first chapter? And let's start with you, Danielle.
It's the first chapter because of what we found coaching couples. Over the years, we've realized that couples are less likely to divorce and go their separate ways when they realize what their bigger picture and purpose and imprint is on the world and within their homes. And so research shows that the love experience, you know, the butterfly, the shimmies, all of that only lasts for about 2 years. And then after the 2 years, you have to try to transition into like an intentional, purposeful love. So for us, we wanted to talk about that and really implore people to kind of look into that, take the time to figure it out in their relationships. Likely to divorce, there's like a bigger meaning behind it all.
So Howard, you and Danielle are married. Spoiler, everyone who didn't know that was the nature of their relationship. How what did your journey for your why look and sound like?
Yeah, you know, first we had to realize that we needed it. And so, like many people with Dan, when I first got married, I married Dan because I was fond of how beautiful she was. She was incredibly goal-oriented and talented. And she, I always used to say she was the nicest person in the world. But those things are still true about her. However, they're not really sustainable.
It's no secret that raising a child is expensive.
Of marriages. So we came to this. We came to a place, oddly enough, 11 years into our marriage, where we felt like we didn't have a North Star for what we were doing in life. We didn't have a guiding principle to our marriage. Danielle had been very successful in her career at that point. God had blessed me in my career at that point individually, but there was no glue to our marriage entity. And so we prayed, and prayer and fasting was important to us in 2016. And what it did was it allowed us to realize that we had some similarities through gifts and talents and passions that were that we hadn't really operated in. We hadn't did anything in the space of marriage formally. And when that aha moment went off for our marriage, it took our marriage to the next level. Because now, as Dale truly noted, that love experience, obviously we're 11 years, so we're 9 years past that 2 years, had worn off. And we had something else that was we were excited and charged about within our marriage that was not impacted whether or not finance was what we wanted to be or whether or not romance was what it wanted to be or whether or not we weren't going through some type of challenge or seasonality pattern in our marriage. We were always passionate about our purpose. And so our purpose always made our marriage invigorating.
So, Danielle, what is then your purpose? What, as you guys are a couple, what did you decide those few years ago after fasting and prayer, and then how does that exhibit itself in your lives today?
We discovered that our purpose, which we kind of was already operating in it prior to, even though, like Howard said, we had different respective careers, but we realized that our experience in marriage, the abilities to navigate our challenges and to come out successful on the other side was like a major benefit. Talking to people about marriage, helping people understand the expectations of marriage, getting married, staying married, all of those things is what we discovered was our purpose. And since that time, since we got together, people have always asked us for marriage advice. Young people, young marriages, old marriages. It didn't matter. Even though we were only married for like a year or two or three, people always asked us, but we didn't see that as like a thing. You know what I mean? We didn't see it as a general purpose per se until we like sat down, like Howard said, and said, okay, listen, what is the goal and focus of our particular marriage? And so then after that, we just went hard in the yard. Like, okay, we're going to be the mouthpiece, the sounding board. When you see us, you're going to see marriage enrichment, marriage encouragement, all things marriage.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Danielle and Howard Taylor. They are authors of the book, The Fundamentals of Marriage. And we're talking about the first fundamental, which is the you, I, and the why, that kind of defining our purpose. So I sort of envision in my mind's eye the couple, right? One person who listens to the Lisa show and says, you know what? We got to find a purpose. So then they get home and they say to their spouse, listen to this thing on the radio today, have to find our purpose. And they sit down and go, what's our purpose? And then after a few moments of frustration, they go, oh, I wonder what the kids are doing, or I wonder if there's something that's on TV that we should watch. How can couples do this and do it successfully?
Yeah, we think it's very important for couples to be intentional in defining their relationship or their marriage as a separate entity from everything else, separate from what you're about as an individual, separate from what your spouse is passionate about, it's separate from your parenting. Marriage is its own entity. And so if you started any other business or any other entity, it's important to begin to do practical steps in defining what that entity is going to be. And so for Danielle and I, as we took the practical step of first seeking out what our purpose is, we then began to come up with mission statements, gifts and talents, or if our gifts and talents deferred, how can we apply those to the mission statement of our marriage, right? Just like you would do in a business environment, some who work in that environment, right? You have this goal or this motto or this mission statement, and then you say, okay, well, how does your administrative skills lend themselves to marriage for Dale and I, or how does your visionary skills lend itself to goal planning for our marriage? And so I think what couples need to do is not overanalyze and overthink it. They need to start with maybe what are some innate gifts or talents that they have. Write those things down, right? Get them on a board somewhere. They need to talk about things or think about things like, what has life experience Where has life experience taken me? A lot of our purpose and our passions come from what we've experienced in life. And I would say, finally, what are our strong convictions? What bothers you? What bothers not just you? I think it's important for thinking about purpose in marriage to think about what bothers my husband and I. You know, what do we screw over at night? These are the things that helps you define what you're going to be passionate about enough to call it your purpose or your North Star for your marriage.
Now, Danielle, Howard said a mission statement, which makes me think that might be something that is written out and memorized. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Is there, in fact, a Taylor family or Taylor, you and Howard relationship mission statement that you could cite for us?
Our short mission statement from the beginning was just to make marriage cool again. Everything emanated from making marriage cool again. Helping people get married and stay married, okay?
Yeah.
So that's what we kind of live off of. We always remind ourselves of that. Because marriage is, you know, in some cultures right now, in some generations, marriage is like a dying art, you know what I mean? Because of all of that, all the things that we've seen growing up, all the things going on in the world, some people feel like, well, why even bother? That's been our mission statement for us.
There are a lot of people that I think can really grab hold to this. And then I think that there are some people that really struggle, right? Maybe because of the pandemic, they have found themselves without a job or, you know, taking a job just to be able to make ends meet. And that there's nothing like a job change or a life shift. Maybe kids are moving out of the house or whatever that really brings to home if you don't have a purpose. To those folks who really genuinely kind of feel lost in this, whether it's the one or the both in the couple, you had mentioned fasting and prayer, being able to find that North Star. To those that are really lost, what can we say to them?
I wanted to say really fast. I think that for those going through difficult times right now from a job loss or the other, now would be the perfect time to really settle down and have a clear mind on what is it that I'm really called to do? What is that thing that I actually love? We get so caught up in like basically getting jobs and just what pays the most money, what's going to help ends meet, like what can I do for today? You know what I mean? Not necessarily what can I do for 10 years down the line or 20 years down the line. Mm-hmm. So I think that now is the perfect time to just sit down and look within. What do I love? When you're at work, you're not, depending on your work, I should say, for me personally, let me just go there. when I worked in law enforcement, I used to work in law enforcement for like 12 years. When I worked in law enforcement, I had no creative energy, no thought, no time, no nothing to think about what it is that I actually liked. Okay. I was just thinking about my job every day. But once I left that job, when I started having children, that's when all the ideas and possibilities open to me about what I actually liked as a person. So I feel like people should use this time, the uncertainty, the lost jobs, like all of that, just to hone in on how can I pivot my life, past job or whatever the changes are, to going into the direction of what I really actually envision for my life and what I want to see. Like Howard said, what am I good at? What do people give me compliments about? Like what am I researching all night? What would I do for free? Those things, I think we need to come back into ourselves and dig them out. You know, when you're working for a long time, all of that stuff is buried and long gone. And I don't know if Howard wanted to add. I know I just took over, but.
No, that was awesome, man. You know you're wonderful.
Well,
thank you.
Well, I got a question for you then, Howard. Would your kids know what your mission statement is as a couple?
Yeah, so it's so funny you mentioned that. We have a six-year-old. We have two sons, but our six-year-old, we call him the Marriage on Deck boy because he's into superheroes right now. So at six, he right now knows when mommy and daddy have interviews. He right now knows why we do it, because what will happen is inevitably when you find purpose or passion, it begins to have its own time in your family, right? And so your son ultimately will, or your daughter, they'll begin to see that you're dedicating time to this purpose. And kids are, hey, listen, I love my children, but sometimes children become an all-consuming fire, especially in the pandemic where their elementary school is your dining room or your living room. And so our son, because he's so closely attached to us right now, he's asked us oftentimes, well, why do you need to get on a Zoom call with a couple? Or why do you do this? And so we have surely, to answer your question, make sure that our son knows that mommy and daddy are putting the cool back in marriage, mm-hmm. and we do that by doing A, B, and C. Zoom interview, radio interview, TV interview. This is why we wrote the book. He has pictures with our book. And so marrying him to our purpose and even giving him a role as the superhero of Marriage on Deck allows him not to resent the time that we put forward to our passion.
We've been talking all about the fundamentals of marriage and this first piece, the you, the I, and the why, the purpose behind all these things. Is it a fundamental beyond having that purpose within the couple's relationship, but having a purpose for a family? And is that an additional sort of mission statement or mantra, or is that lumped into what the couples have?
I think it is important to have an additional purpose for the family at large, because if you have children, or if you don't have children, but I think it is important because it shows the kids that there is a bigger meaning beyond what they see in the home. Right. So kids understand our parents go to work and they come home, but they don't really see that as like a purpose per se. And your work may be your purpose, but do the children know that? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. What are you doing how is your family impacting the community? Like, how are you impacting your street? How is your family impacting your world? Howard has a good example when he says, like, marriage is like a farm, you know. How is your farming helping other people? What is your crop doing for the rest of the world at large? Mm-hmm. And so I think having and the purpose may be the same for some people. You know what I mean? They may say our marriage purpose and our family purpose is the same. We're going to go out there and help end world hunger, you know, and that's totally cool and fine. So I think that it depends on what it is. And I would say, yes, I think it's important to have it as a whole as a family. And if you don't necessarily have a family, then make sure you develop one in just your marriage.
10-year-old Richie on Christmas, now however many years ago that was, opened up a package from his dad, and he thought, why is my dad giving me business cards? And on the business card, it had our last name, and underneath our last name, it had the following saying. It said, "We are the Steadmans." That's my last name. It said, "We are the Steadmans.
Nice.
We care about each other. We work together to help each other be happy." And it was so cheesy and lame as a 10-year-old. I'll be honest with you. I thought, Dad, what are we doing here? But he recognized the strength and the value in being able to institute that with us as children. To the, you know, we did like the get in car, and he would say, "All right, everyone, let's hear the motto, the mantra," and we would say it begrudgingly and, you know, with tones that would let us know that we didn't appreciate it. But here I am all those years later and have been able to find tremendous strength by being able to draw on the words that my dad put on that small business card those many Christmases ago.
Absolutely.
So, U, I, and Y, it's the first fundamental of marriage. We've been joined with Danielle and Howard Taylor. They are authors of the book, The Fundamentals of Marriage. You can get more information on them, great tips, and being able to find their book as well by visiting their website, which is marriageondeck.com.
Coming up, we're going to help you find new life in a struggling relationship.
You're listening to The Lisa Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Most people know the saying that once something is on the internet, it never leaves. But is that really true? If you have social media or accounts set up on different websites or even just a computer, it's most likely that your information is out there. So, what's being done with that data? Who can see it? And is it ever possible to really get something off of the internet? Whether it's an embarrassing video or something maybe more serious, we want to find out if, in fact, it is possible to remove it from the internet. So to help us, we've invited Haley Kaplan, an internet privacy expert, to share some advice. Welcome, Haley.
Thank you.
So first of all, it's great to have you back on the show. Enjoyed our conversation with you so much before. We thought, man, this internet thing is much bigger than just one 15-minute segment. Let's get Haley back and be able to talk about, is it possible to actually remove something from the internet if it has been put out there?
Yes, but no at the same time. So it's very, very dependent on what kind of information it is. For the most part, in actuality, everything is removable because somebody put it there, right? So if you reach that person, you can remove it, and you can remove it from as many places as it's gotten to. But in actuality and the reality of things is people aren't often willing to do that. So bottom line is you want to be real careful with what you do and what you post. Because some of it is up there because of stuff you did, and some of it is there without your knowledge and without your control.
Yeah, I, as a parent, just anecdotally, I would always say, hey, before you're thinking about posting something online, think if in 20 years you're still going to want to be there. And my son would kind of look at me sort of blank face, and I'd be like, and then I want you to think if I might be upset that it's still there in 20 years, and hopefully creating those kind of couple of stops that we go, is this something that we really want to have be out there? And that's if we're posting something that we ourselves are controlling. So often, as you indicate, it might be something that somebody else is sharing about us.
Yes, and you know, sometimes intentionally somebody's sharing it for malicious reasons or sometimes innocent reasons, but then there's other stuff that generates from public records, from newspaper articles, and that is the kind of stuff that people like your kid have absolutely no control over, except to behave well in the first place and not do stuff that would cause it to get on there in the first place.
Yeah. When, probably most popular, I think about friends, whether they're in real life or just social media friends who have said, you know what, I'm leaving this platform, whatever that social media platform may be. I'm disabling my account. I'm done. I'm gone. Is their information actually gone or is that stored somewhere?
Oh, it's definitely stored there, and I don't recommend that at all.
You don't recommend removing yourself?
I don't recommend removing yourself from a social media platform, because if you're not on that platform, you can't see what other people are saying about you. At least if you're on there, you don't have to post and you can control what you're putting on there, but you can still be a voyeur to what other people are posting.
What would be the value in that? Just knowing that if someone is saying something negative or malicious, you can be able to contact it at the source?
Yeah, or unintentional as well. Do you have time for a quick story?
Of course.
I'm on Facebook, and I see a friend of mine who's very influential in the community. Oh, my God. She's at a party, and clearly someone's given it to her. There's people all around her. This is really inappropriate. Imagine what her kids are going to think. Imagine what other people in the community are going to think. So I discreetly call her up, and I tell her, you know, I came across this picture. And she said to me, well, I know, but somebody else posted it, and so I have no control. And I said, absolutely you do. The person that posted it thinks it's funny. It's not funny at all that it's there. You need to contact her and ask her to take it down. And so she did, and the woman did take it down. So that's an example where somebody posted it. If she wasn't on social media, well, I would have found it in that particular case since I went to her. But what happens if I hadn't and no one else was comfortable letting her know that it was there? Then it would have been there forever and would have looked pretty bad. You can imagine, you know, a picture like that in the wrong eyes, how that would come across.
Absolutely. You know, I think about these experiences, and I've seen this in our local community where there are businesses that have posted pictures on their business social media page. And this was fairly early on. I feel like we've sort of self-corrected and people have known better than this. But in the early times of the pandemic, we're sharing pictures. I'm thinking of one that particular was a wedding venue where no one was masked. There were, you know, too many people for the city and local restrictions under the pandemic, and nobody was masked. And I remember the blowback and just bad press that this particular venue got because they had shared a picture that just said that they were disregarding what was going on. And they, of course, deleted it, but several people had screenshotted it before they got the chance to remove it.
Right. And that is one of the things about removing. So once something is removed, if it's removed properly, number one, it gets removed from the site. Number two, it has to be removed from Google, because what a lot of people don't realize is that result can still remain in Google, and there's a teeny little down arrow next to the top line of the Google result. And if you click on that down arrow, the word cached pops up, and then you can click on the word cached, and then you can see what was there before it was deleted. So removals are a couple of steps. You've got a number one from the site, number two from search engines as well.
Now, if we want to find out about ourselves, the kind of presence, the stamp that we have on the internet or in the digital space, what maybe aside from Googling, or is Googling the best way to find that out?
There's so many different ways that your information is captured that Googling is definitely the first best step, but it's not the final step. So there's a lot of different ways to Google yourself. You don't just want to put in your name. And depending on the person's name, it's going to be very different because some people have common names. And so a lot of other stuff is going to come up. So you want to start to give Google a little bit more information about yourself as you're doing the search to make sure that you're seeing everything that pertains to you without having to go through all this other stuff. There are specific search terms. There's advanced searches. You can go to Google how to do advanced searches, and that will show you how to exclude certain bits of information, include more. One of the things that I like to do, because one of the services that I offer that's important to people for removing personal information that's not only on Google but on a bunch of different data broker sites. So this isn't the reputation stuff. This is just name, age, family members' address, criminal records, licenses you may own, all sorts of just stuff that comes in from public records, from official public records, and is picked up by those sites. So one of the tricks that I use is to put your name and your address. And that will pick up a lot of the Google results that include your name and address together. But there's over 300 sites out there that gather that kind of information, and they're not all optimized to come into Google. So there's some very common sites that are very invasive, very popular sites. And so you want to go directly to some of those sites to find that information and to remove it as well. And we've been talking a lot about social media, but there's so many types of information that come up online that are not social media as well. So you don't want to restrict yourself to social media because you could be missing out the most important stuff. For example, in my work, I'll have people coming to me with all sorts of problematic posts for them. Maybe they got into a dispute with a customer. Maybe they got into a dispute personally with someone. Maybe there was a sexual harassment situation. And people will create websites just to badmouth and ruin somebody's reputation.
Wow.
So you've really got to be looking for more than official sites. And so the first step of knowing what to do is to be diligent about always looking yourself up on Google. They've got, right now there's all these things on the media about them being a monopoly, but the truth is I find that to be a very handy search engine. It does track everything you're doing. So I also use another one called Epic. But since Google is so popular and so common, it's really important to see what's on there, because what's on Google may not be exactly the same as what's on some of the other search engines. They don't all pick up the identical thing.
Yeah, just using it as another source. We're talking, if you're just listening to us, we're talking with Haley Kaplan, who is an internet privacy expert. You mentioned that a lot of this that we've been discussing, you will actually do for clients, people who come to you and say, hey, help me, you know, remove this information from the internet. Do you find that most people come to you in cases of, you know, oh, I did this silly thing when I was younger and I want that to disappear? Or is it more they want to be kind of anonymous and not have big data have their information? Who are those that use and patronize your services the most?
That's hard to say, because almost every single person that comes to me comes with a different situation and a different set of needs. So, for example, if somebody's been raped or a victim of stalking, what's most important to them is that they can't be found in terms of their home address.
Yeah.
So there's not reputational issues at stake here. It's just really safety. So it's really important that I am very, very thorough about removing anything that would lead to where they are physically located. Then there are people that you mentioned, someone that may have had a misstep, maybe a kid in school had a DUI, and this is following them 20 years later on the internet, and they don't want to be punished forever. I'm about to do a consult with somebody who has a bankruptcy, and that's hurting her. There was someone who had bikini photos online, and she actually told me that she had done a photo shoot when she was underage, and now that she was working for a company, it wasn't professional to have bikini photos up there. The company had gone out of business, too, since then. But when I started to do my homework and my research, it turned out that she really was 18, and she'd entered a bikini contest for a prize and won. Congratulations to her.
Yeah.
And so it really was her actions that caused it to be up there. But when you're 18, you're not thinking, when I'm 28 and these bikini pictures are showing up and I'm in a professional position, that really is awkward. So people have to start to really think about what they're doing and what the consequences are, because they're ending up online. Number one, inadvertently, by mistake, people find it out. And number two, when people are unhappy, they're really taking to the online world to let it be known, and they're harming people in terrible, terrible ways.
There is so much that I would imagine, too, that has grown within this space that we're just sort of constantly learning, and things that we would have maybe never considered at the advent of the internet, that now we're saying, oh, this is being tracked, this is being followed, people can find this information. Where for people that are concerned about this, maybe they want to take some things in their own hands, or maybe even hire you. What is a great resource to be able to start to either take back their information or really get an idea of internet safety?
Well, on my website, I have a couple websites. My main website is what-is-privacy.com. And in the upper right-hand corner of that site, I have a blog. And I have dedicated many, many, many hundreds of hours to writing articles to help people about being safe online. So there's that sort of informational guidance on very specific areas. And you can click on one of the subjects that's remove online information, and then you'll find articles related to that. I offer a lot of free tutorials on how to remove yourself from data broker sites. I don't put in a lot of information about removing other types of information because, as I said from the start, it's so diverse.
Yeah.
What happened? I had a client that came to me where one of his clients was very upset, and he put a very pornographic photograph online that was showing up. He is an attorney, and he had a very taboo type of photograph with naked people in the background and him doing something indiscreet. The good thing was, because there was some pornography involved, there are laws associated, well, not laws, but Google, for example, will remove revenge porn if something is breaking copyright. Now, they'll remove it from the search engine, which is great, because they're not saying you have to get it off of the site first, but then there's so many search engines, so you really do want to go to the source.
Yeah.
But when people are using Google a lot, and suddenly, you know, with these law firms, there's this naked picture, it's a huge problem.
Right.
So it's nice that Google has a mechanism, because it fits into the category of revenge porn, to remove it right away.
Yeah.
But then you have to use other means to get to the source, which it was coming from a website that this particular person created specifically to shame this lawyer because he was mad that he wouldn't keep him as a client.
Wow. And these types of things in different ways constantly occurring, people finding new ways to be able to do this. A conversation that I don't know that we'll ever get to the bottom of everything, but that I've really enjoyed being able to talk about how we can remove some information from the internet, and giving your website, which is what-is-privacy.com, as a resource is a tremendous benefit to those that have been listening to this conversation. We've been visiting with
another site. I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I just launched a brand new site called removeonlineinfo.com.
And another great place that people can be able to find out similar, I would imagine.
Yes, I just because it's new, I don't have a lot of articles associated with it yet, but I intend to put articles specifically related to that over time, at least one a month.
Awesome.
So that will hopefully be a resource, and I've got a contact form if people have questions, because again, we've not even come close to skimming the surface of the subject matter. Mm-hmm. There is one of the questions that I didn't quite get to, is everything removable? And I said yes and no. So going back to that, some stuff that can't be removed, there's still things that you can do to lessen the reputation damage. And that's not some, that's not a service I do myself, but it's still important to know about it, where you build other positive content to push the result down. But first step is always, on anything that's problematic, to try to remove it, because even though it's very daunting and you may think it's never going to be done, just like the person with that photograph, it was, and she was so relieved, and it wasn't that hard to remove in that particular case. And if other people had captured screenshots, they weren't sharing them.
Right.
So that was a good thing.
Yeah.
So
You are a tremendous resource. We hope that we can have you again on the show. Haley Kaplan, internet privacy expert. And we will leave the show note in the show notes, those websites that you shared with us. Thank you so much for being on the show with us.
And thank you for being part of The Lisa Show. The Lisa Show at BYU.edu is where you go to send us guest suggestions, topic suggestions, or nominations for our everyday rock stars, which we love to celebrate with you.
Doing that on tomorrow's Lisa Show, so make sure you get your everyday rock star in today. It's The Lisa Show at BYU.edu.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on the BYU Radio app, where you can listen on demand. You can also find us on Sirius XM channel 143.
Pray tell, did you know that we have a podcast? You can find it and subscribe to it. You won't miss a single moment of this here show. Find The Lisa Show wherever you listen to podcasts.
And share with a friend. Today's the day. On tomorrow's show, we're going to learn how to salvage a family relationship with someone that we really disagree with.
Thank you for making The Lisa Show a part of your day.